Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
After an eight-month search, American officials announced the capture of Saddam Hussein in a rural area south of his hometown. It's Sunday, December 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. In this hour, we'll have reports on how the Iraqi leader was captured, how Iraqis are responding, and how the world responds. A member of the Iraqi Governing Council considers how to put Saddam on trial, and NPR's Mara Liasson reports on how the capture may affect the presidential campaign. Also, an American soldier and his family consider what the capture means for them.
Concern is about the whole war. You know, is it necessary? Should we be there? You know, all the innocent people have gotten killed, you know, recently. This thing, we should not be there.
We will also this hour look back at Saddam Hussein's long career, and we'll start with this update on the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Deposed Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is in U.S. custody and is being questioned at an undisclosed location after being captured last night at a farm near his hometown of Tikrit. U.S. forces, following up on a tip from a family described as close to Saddam, raided the farm. Hundreds of troops scoured the primitive buildings. They first found $750,000 in U.S. currency. And then NPR's Ivan Watson says they focused on a suspicious patch of dirt outside a small building.
There, next to a very humble-looking building that had a kitchen with some running water, a plastic chair under a little porch, according to a photo that the U.S. military released, there they found what they described as a spider hole, a small hole dug into the ground with a ventilation pipe. Its entrance was camouflaged, again according to the U.S. military, and in there they found the former Iraqi leader, Saddam Hussein, with a long, bushy beard, with unkept long hair.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Saddam was said to be disoriented and bewildered, but later some members of the Iraqi Governing Council met with him briefly. By then his hair and beard had been cut, and they described him as defiant and insisting that he had been a just and fair ruler. President Bush said Saddam's capture marks an important turning point for the people of Iraq.
In the history of Iraq, a dark and painful era is over. A hopeful day has arrived. All Iraqis can now come together and reject violence and build a new Iraq.
Mr. Bush said Saddam will now face the justice he denied his own people. Soldiers on military bases across the U.S. are reacting to the news of Saddam's capture with joy and relief. North Country Radio's David Summerstein reports that troops at Fort Drum in upstate New York are also cautious about the future.
People at this army base were surprised and happy to learn of Saddam Hussein's capture. Specialist Matt Crane was on break visiting his family.
I was upstairs packing to come back, and my folks told me. I came running down. It's amazing.
While having Saddam in U.S. custody gives soldiers and their families a sense of relief, there's also a hesitance to celebrate too much. Tony Lusada is a security officer on post.
Well, I think it takes one of the key players out of the picture. However, there's still other people that are willing to step up to the plate for him, so I don't think we're done.
Thousands of Fort Drum soldiers have served or continue to serve in Iraq and in anti-terrorism missions in Afghanistan. Most who remain on base still believe, despite the latest news, that their call up to duty will come soon. For NPR News, I'm David Summerstein in northern New York.
Saddam's capture set off celebrations in the streets of Iraq. Guns fired into the air in Kirkuk by rebels killed eight people. Many Iraqis expressed surprise that Saddam put up no resistance when he was found. This is NPR News from Washington. A U.S. military spokesman says the capture of Saddam Hussein could help in the search for the other man most wanted in the world, Osama bin Laden. A spokesman says Saddam's fate is already sparking an increase in the flow of intelligence. Bin Laden is believed to be hiding in the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf narrowly escaped an assassination attempt today. A bomb exploded just seconds after his motorcade had passed by on a roadway near the airport in Islamabad. Musharraf called the attack a terrorist act. Former U.S. Senator William Roth has died. The Republican from Delaware was best known for creating the Roth Individual Retirement Account. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
During his five terms in the Senate, William Roth relentlessly pushed tax cuts. He co-authored the Kemp-Roth tax cuts in 1981 and oversaw several inquiries into financial malfeasance. One such inquiry uncovered Pentagon spending abuses, including a $9,600 wrench. But Roth's most significant legacy is the retirement account named after him. The Roth IRA is still widely used today. In 2000, Roth lost his Senate seat to former Delaware Governor Tom Carper. Roth was born in Montana and moved to Delaware in the 50s. He collapsed late Saturday at his daughter's home. He was 82. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
For the second straight weekend, the northeastern states have been hit by a pre-winter snowstorm. Parts of Pennsylvania got half a foot of snow today, and Maine is bracing for 2 feet of snow. In South Boston, residents have begun the time-honored tradition of reserving parking spots that they claimed for themselves after shoveling out from heavy snow last weekend. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Steve Inskeep. As we've been reporting throughout this day, Saddam Hussein, the former Iraqi leader, is in American custody. The U.S. military says it found Saddam last night hiding in a hole in the ground outside his hometown of Tikrit. Now, over the course of this hour, we will have updates on how the U.S. found him, and we will also consider who could put Saddam on trial. This afternoon, President Bush addressed the nation and said Saddam will face the justice that he denied to millions.
The capture of this man was crucial to the rise of a free Iraq. It marks the end of the road for him and for all who bullied and killed in his name. For the Ba'athist holdouts, largely responsible for the current violence, there will be no return to the corrupt power and privilege they once held. For the vast majority of Iraqi citizens who wish to live as free men and women, this event brings further assurance that the torture chambers and the secret police are gone forever.
President Bush addressing the nation this afternoon from the White House. In Baghdad, news of Saddam's capture was greeted with cheers and celebratory gunfire. Saddam Hussein was actually captured yesterday. Military and administration officials took that news secret until they confirmed the former Iraqi leader's identity, and they say he's now being held in an undisclosed location. The details of the capture and Saddam's condition tell a dramatic story of the deposed leader's changed fortunes, and NPR's Jennifer Ludden has more.
By the time the U.S. confirmed the capture early this morning, word had spread to U.S. government officials who rushed to their offices in the wee hours, to TV networks who went on the air live, and to the Iraqis who shouted from cars and shot guns in the air in celebration. In Baghdad, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer addressed a room of military officials and foreign and Iraqi reporters.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, then rolled out a video. It showed a soldier checking for head lice and probing the mouth of a haggard man with deep lines in his face and a bushy, graying beard.
This is Saddam as he was being given his medical examination today.
Several Iraqi journalists jumped to their feet, jabbed the air, and shouted, "Down with Saddam." President Bush later told aides that reaction touched him greatly. Later, Major General Ray Odierno, commander of the 4th Infantry Division that carried out the raid, offered more details of the capture. Odierno said for months, military officials have been working Saddam's family and tribal ties, gleaning increasing information with each high-profile capture of a former Saddam aide.
Over the last 10 days or so, we brought in about 5 to 10 members of these families who then were able to give us even more information. And finally, we got the ultimate information from one of these individuals.
That information came yesterday, and within an hour and a half, according to Lieutenant General Sanchez, the U.S. launched Operation Red Dawn. Some 600 troops went to scout 2 sites in the village of Adwar, some 10 miles outside Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Their mission, he said, was to kill or capture the former leader. At first, they turned up nothing, but after troops caught 2 men trying to flee the area, they set up a cordon and intensified their search. Pointing to enlarged photographs, Major General Odierno described a walled compound with a mud hut and metal lean-to. In the center of it, he said soldiers lifted a rug, removed bricks and dirt, and found a styrofoam insert. Below that, he said, they found a so-called spider hole, 6 to 8 feet deep, just large enough for one person to lie in, with a ventilation tube for air. Saddam was in the hole.
It was a very narrow hole that was not very big at all. And very interesting that, in fact, you could just about see some of these palace complexes from there. And I think it's rather ironic that he was in a hole in the ground across the river from these great palaces that he's built, where he robbed all the money from the Iraqi people.
Odierno said Saddam had a pistol in his lap, but did not move to use it. In fact, he offered no resistance and admitted who he was. Lieutenant General Sanchez said Saddam later became talkative and cooperative, but at the time of his capture, officials described him as somewhat disoriented.
Tired. He was a tired man. And also, I think, a man resigned to his fate.
Military officials say they've not identified the two other men captured at the compound. They also confiscated two AK-47 guns, $750,000 in $100 bills, and a white and orange taxi. Major General Odierno said the village is near the Tigris River and there are boats nearby, either for Saddam to travel, he said, or perhaps for supporters to bring him supplies. Officials did not say whether anyone will be rewarded the $25 million bounty for Saddam's capture. For a man who regularly used doubles to evade opponents, there seemed little doubt this was Saddam Hussein. An Iraqi official said preliminary DNA testing had proved his identity, and U.S. officials said more testing was underway. Officials also shaved his scraggly beard and showed his likeness to previous photographs. Adnan Pachachi, a senior member of the U.S.-backed Iraqi Governing Council, expressed widespread relief at the capture. He spoke through an interpreter.
Thank God, the arrest of the tyrant, and we hope has happened, and we hope that this will open the door to continue in our campaign to rebuild Iraq and to regain its sovereignty and freedom and to look forward.
U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer called on Iraq's various factions to now reconcile and on opposition elements to help build a new Iraq. But it's far from clear that Saddam will issue any call for a ceasefire. Several Iraqi governing council members visited him in captivity and asked about the assassinations and massacres that have come to light since his departure. They said he seemed unrepentant and defiant. It's unclear what the U.S. will do with Saddam Hussein next. Administrator Bremer says no decision's yet been made, but Iraqi officials just days ago created a sweeping special tribunal. They're already speaking of putting on public trial the man who ruled and abused them for more than three decades. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
As we've heard, there was rejoicing in the streets of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities at the news of the former dictator's capture, and some citizens of Iraq are demanding a trial for Saddam Hussein. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The signature sound of gunfire that typically accompanies momentous occasions like weddings and funerals ricocheted through the streets. Shop owners shuttered their storefronts, fearing the celebrations were getting too dangerous. The crackle of gunfire mixed with the din of car horns. Iraqis who were once jailed for the misdemeanor of making a wrong turn into a Saddam motorcade tonight owned the streets. A truckload of young Shiite men celebrated with chants to Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, whose martyrdom precipitated the rupture between Shiites and Sunnis. With four-letter words, they denounced Saddam. The nation was spellbound as the top U.S. general in Iraq displayed a video of a disheveled Saddam, his mouth pried open for doctors who prodded for the DNA evidence that would prove his identity. For many Iraqis watching, the joy at his capture was tinged with a sense of humiliation, both Saddam's and their own. Qusay Jassam hawked Christmas decorations in this city where Christians are a small minority and spoke of the shame of watching Saddam brought low. All Iraqis are humiliated, Jassam said. If you ask any one of us, we would say it would have been better if Saddam had killed himself rather than being captured by foreign forces. Worse yet, he adds, he put up no fight. Iraqis looked forward to holding Saddam to account. A special tribunal with Iraqi judges and prosecutors announced last week would try the former Iraqi president. Restaurant maitre d' Joseph Antoine Youssef said justice would prevail. He will have a fair trial from the Iraqi people, and the Americans won't interfere with this trial, Youssef says. It will be as thorough as any proceeding against other presidents who have faced serious crimes before the tribunal at The Hague, he says. Youssef cautioned his countrymen against indulging in the belief that the troubled times of insecurity, gas shortages, and power outages would quickly end with Saddam's capture. Things will not change overnight, he said, but in time. A group of Iraqi journalists seemed to speak most clearly tonight for the millions who have suffered under Saddam. At the news conference announcing his capture, they were unable to contain their emotions and rose on behalf of their country to say, "Long live Iraq." "Death to Saddam," they added. "We want him punished."
We're listening to NPR's Julie McCarthy in Baghdad. And Julie, I want to ask about one other development in Iraq today. On this same day that Saddam Hussein was, his capture was announced, there was a bombing at a police station. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, there was a huge bombing. As this story of his capture was unfolding, I was standing at the aftermath of an explosion at a police station in the town of Khaldiya, some 50 miles west of Baghdad. You know, it's in this area known as the Sunni Triangle, which is the focal point of anti-American resistance. And the attack was an exceptionally powerful one. 17 people were killed. And it's just the latest violence directed against the Iraqi police, who insurgents view as collaborators. The police are trained and paid by the U.S. occupational authority and therefore have been targeted. They are supposed to work alongside the U.S. forces, but police in this town refuse to go on raids with them. They say they don't like them. They are too inflammatory. And as a measure of the mistrust that exists between the Iraqis there and the American forces, even the policemen said the attack had been staged by the U.S. so that they could blame terrorists and stay on. Eyewitnesses described a plane, a whizzing sound of a missile just before the explosion. And there was a huge crater in front of the police station. The U.S. military says it was a car bomb, and a destroyed car, in fact, sits in front of the bombed station. So as with many incidents, there are competing versions of events.
Reminder, if we needed one, that the war continues. Julie McCarthy in Baghdad, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to hear next from a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, the group set up by the United States to administer Iraq. Dr. Ayed Alawi is the head of the Governing Council's Security Committee. We have found him in London. He's on his way back to Iraq after coming to the United States to consult with U.S. government officials. And Dr. Ayed, just very simply, how does the capture of Saddam affect what you're trying to do in Iraq?
Well, first of all, let me say that everybody is really jubilant in Iraq. This was great news. We believe that Saddam's capture would start a new chapter in Iraq. Definitely it's a blow to the forces of evil, to terrorists. This does not mean that they are going to cease functioning, but this is a big blow. I hope this will be followed by other blows. And I think Iraq is en route to recovery.
Dr. Ayed, will people representing the Iraqi Governing Council play any role in interrogating Saddam Hussein?
I hope so. As you know, some members have gone already and met with Saddam in his hour of capture. I hope people would go and help the coalition interrogating him and the rest of the criminals. This is what we will be definitely pressing for, and this is our right, really.
Do you hope that he will now be put on trial, and if so, where?
It should be Baghdad, and he should be put on a trial, and I think the trial that he should be put in should be a very public and within the norms, and justice should prevail, the justice that he denied the Iraqi people from. We should put him in a trial. He should be allowed to bring any lawyers to defend him. It should be even a public trial.
Difficult question, though, because what is the law under which you will try this man?
The existing law is really the old law in Iraq. It has not changed yet. We regarded the law with a bit of amendments and corrections as still holding until the Iraqis really can do their new constitution, their new law, after an election.
What are some charges that might be brought against him?
There are plenty of charges ranging from war crimes to genocide to ordinary normal assassinations, murders, imprisonments, looting the wealth of the nation, stealing, thieving, you know, name it, and it is really there. He committed so many crimes. 2 weeks ago, just before me traveling, I leveled a lawsuit against him and against his brother for planning, masterminding, and inciting an assassination attempt against myself. It was the first decree by an Iraqi judge and produced a warrant to arrest him.
Dr. Ayed, I know there are very many Iraqis who feel that they've been harmed by Saddam Hussein, who feel that their family members have been imprisoned, tortured, or killed, which does raise the question of whether he can receive a fair trial inside Iraq.
Well, there is nowhere to try to put him on trial. You know, he have committed so many crimes against the Iraqis that he have to be tried in Iraq.
Dr. Ayed Alawi is a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. Dr. Ayed, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
In his statement today, President Bush promised justice for Saddam Hussein, but left open the question of exactly how and where that justice would be done. Today, a senior administration official tells NPR that U.S. policy has been for Iraqis to put Saddam on trial inside Iraq. Saddam is considered likely to face a war crimes tribunal made up of Iraqi judges. The Iraqi Governing Council decided to set up such a tribunal just days ago. But U.S., Iraqi, and other officials are still debating the rules and the possible crimes under which Saddam would be tried. Joining us now is Judge Patricia Wald. From 1999 to 2001, she sat on the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and we're hoping she can provide us some insight on this situation. She's now a fellow at the Yale Law School and chair of the Open Society Institute's Criminal Justice Initiative. Judge Wald, let me start with this question. In a situation like this, where there is not already an established legal system to handle a person like Saddam Hussein, how do you make any criminal proceeding legal? How do you make it legitimate?
Well, the normal route would be to have the authority, and in this case, I gather they believe it will be the provisional government, whether it's the Iraqi Council or whatever authority there is, usually has to establish a charter or pass a kind of governing statute for the tribunal, which says this tribunal shall have jurisdiction over, and then sets out the kind of crimes that they want it to have jurisdiction over, and some minimum rules of practice for the tribunal, and how the judges are going to be appointed, and how the prosecutor is going to be appointed, and what the rights of the accused are. It can be done quickly, but it has to be fairly comprehensive if it's going to be looked at with legitimacy by the rest of the world.
And this is a dictator who made the laws in Iraq for the last 20-plus years.
Right. I think there is some thinking that in order to find governing Iraqi law that people will have confidence in, they may have to go back several decades. In other words, if there were laws that appear to be fair laws on the books, it may be that they're applicable. But there is several basic questions that have to come to the forefront. One is, what law will they apply? Will they try Saddam Hussein under Iraqi law for crimes that were considered part of the Iraqi criminal law, or will they try him for international crimes, which is quite a different thing, crimes against war, crimes against humanity, genocide, etc.
And some Iraqis are suggesting they're prepared to try Saddam Hussein themselves, but is there a case to be made for an international trial here, an international tribunal?
Yeah, there's certainly a case to be made. I'm not suggesting that a national court couldn't legitimately, of course it can, try one of its own nationals for crimes under national law. But for such a big figure, historic figure, who I assume will be accused of big crimes, there's something to be said for some international presence, either in the way of having a couple of international jurists, even if they're not the majority, from neighboring Mideastern countries, as some have suggested, or even from a larger part of the world, so that if convictions do ensue, the world looks and says this was a record made by people who were outside the country and didn't have any ox to gore. That's the case usually made for having an international tribunal. The other thing, which I think is terribly important, whether it's national or international, is that the trial be public and accessible to the rest of the world.
In your view, how important is it that Saddam Hussein, if he is put on trial, receive some kind of due process?
I think it's terribly important. Justice Jackson, who was the prosecutor at Nuremberg, made that point very forcibly. He said, I'm not so worried about what international law applies, etc. He said there is only one thing that for history, for this to be really a record of the terrible crimes, if he did commit them, then the procedures have to be fair, or history will, later on, 20, 30 years from now, some revisionist history will dismiss it all as a railroading or a sham. And heaven knows it looks as though his crimes are sufficient, so that you want them to be accurately represented on the record, and that means having a fair trial.
Judge Patricia Wald formerly sat on the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And Judge Wald, thanks very much for your time and your insight.
Sure.
And in case you're just joining us, we want to just very briefly review what has happened today before we continue our coverage. Saddam Hussein has been captured. U.S. military officials made that announcement early this morning, Eastern Time, in a news conference that was held in Baghdad. He was actually captured on Saturday night when about 600 American soldiers moved into a village not far from Saddam's hometown of Tikrit. He's now in U.S. custody. Video images showed an unkempt, bearded man being examined by an American doctor. The U.S. military says that it waited one day to spread this news until it could be sure of Saddam's identity. We're told that Iraqi detainees had positively identified Saddam, and we're also told that there was a DNA match, that his DNA confirmed that the U.S. military had its man and had captured Saddam Hussein. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News, and we will continue our coverage throughout the rest of this hour. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes, from the Kington Foundation, supporting Montpelier, the home of President James Madison, father of the Constitution, in Orange, Virginia, on the web at montpelier.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bob Edwards. When it's midnight in your town, the day is just starting somewhere else in the world. But Morning Edition never sleeps. The staff is reporting, editing, and producing 24 hours a day, ready with fresh news before you're ready to start your day. From dusk to dawn, and the other way, too. Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs tomorrow morning from 5 to 10 a.m. here on AM 580. Join us tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. for Focus 580 with your host, David Inch. In the 10 o'clock hour tomorrow, David's guest is Hank Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He can answer your questions about home maintenance. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, the topic is audio and video. Consumer electronics writer Rich Warren will be on hand to answer your questions on audio and video. The Afternoon Magazine follows at noon with your host, Celeste Quinn. In the 1 o'clock hour tomorrow, a conversation with a journalist who witnessed the final years of the Soviet Union. Andrew Meyer was Moscow correspondent for Time from 1996 to 2001. While in the post, he traveled extensively throughout the USSR. He's the author of Black Earth, A Journey Through Russia After the Fall. That's all here tomorrow on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with areas of fog, the low in the mid-20s with southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, shifting to the south after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning, the high in the lower 40s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a chance of light rain after midnight, the low in the upper 30s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. WILL-AM broadcasts from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, made possible by a generous gift from Alice and Robert Campbell.
I'm Craig Windham with these headlines. Deposed Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is in U.S. custody after being captured last night by hundreds of U.S. troops. Saddam was found hiding in a hole in the ground at a farm near his hometown. The U.S. Administrator for Iraq, Paul Bremer, said the tyrant is now a prisoner. The general who commands the Army's 4th Infantry Division says it's unlikely Saddam was directing the Iraqi insurgents. Major General Ray Odierno says no telephones or other communication devices were found in the area where Saddam was captured. The northeastern states are digging out from their second snowstorm in as many weekends. The poor weather is having an impact on holiday shopping traffic, and some retailers say they've begun worrying about whether they'll meet their sales goals for the season. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Steve Inskeep. Throughout this day, congratulations have been pouring into the United States on the capture of Saddam Hussein inside Iraq. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair thanked U.S. troops, their allies, and Iraqi citizens who helped to locate Saddam Hussein.
Where his rule meant terror and division and brutality, let his capture bring about unity, reconciliation, and peace between all the people in Iraq.
Germany's ambassador to the United States, Wolfgang Ischinger, spoke to CNN.
My government has expressed its hope that this very important event will now facilitate the transfer of authority to a future Iraqi government.
And France's ambassador, Jean-David Levite, acknowledged his government's stark disagreements with the U.S. over the war, but said it is time for the countries to move on.
Past is past. What is at stake in Iraq is huge, not only the future of the Iraqi people, but also the future of the whole Middle East and the future of the relations between the Muslim world and the Western world.
Those are some of the reactions today from European countries on the capture of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. As we've learned over the past few years, events that we follow in the United States are often reported very differently in the newspapers and TV networks of the Arab world. And we would like to learn how the capture of Saddam Hussein appears to people in the Middle East. We've called Khaled Al-Maina, who is the editor-in-chief of the Arab News, an English-language newspaper based in Saudi Arabia, and he joins us now from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Mr. Al-Maina, let's begin with the question that must be on your mind. What's your headline going to be for your next edition?
Well, in a couple of hours, we'll have a headline, caught.
Caught.
That's the word, caught. There was another frame of thought, the mother of all captures, because Saddam loved to use that word.
Like the mother of all battles,
caught,
yes.
Yeah, I think caught is with his picture as he's being taken away and being viewed by, I think, a U.S. Army doctor. I think that will dominate our page one.
Well, that's an interesting image that many Americans have seen today, that videotape of Saddam Hussein being examined with wild hair, looks like he needs a haircut, a beard that has grown out gray, and looked rather resigned was the way that one U.S. military official put it. Is that image, that video, all over Arab language television today?
Oh, yes, it has been plastered all over, and people are talking about it, and all TV stations have carried that picture.
And can you give me some idea of how people are responding to that image?
A lot of people were surprised because they expected him to last a few more months hiding. But I think people were happy. And in fact, a lot of people in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf said he got what he deserved. And one thing that also made us more appreciative of the whole situation is that the Americans got to him. We don't want this man to be killed. We want this man to be tried for the murder and the horror that he inflicted on the whole nation and the confusion that he caused all across the world.
And one other thing, if I might, as an Arabic speaker who's got access to Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, just as a television viewer, what has the tone been of the coverage today on those channels?
The tone of the Al Jazeera and other Al Arabiya and others has been quite academic, in fact. I mean, they have been reporting as is. There weren't any wild announcers saying things anti-American or even pro-American. They've been just relaying news, talking about it, speaking, and showing Iraqis cheering and happy and firing guns in the air.
It sounds like the coverage from the U.S. point of view or the Bush administration's point of view is probably a little better in the Middle East than it's been on some other days.
Yes, it has. And I think it's a great thing. I personally think in the Saudis and the Gulf that even that image shows that this is the way tyrants will meet their end. And as you say in America, what goes around comes around.
As a journalist, do you think that your views on this day are widely shared in the Middle East?
Yes, we made a survey, a quick random survey of men, women, and children across Saudi Arabia. The overwhelming majority of the people heaved a sigh of relief.
A sigh of relief?
You know, I mean, this man caused a lot of pain and bloodshed in this area. And we hope that with him, a dark and sad chapter will be closed forever.
Khaled Al-Mayina is the editor-in-chief of the Arab News, an English-language paper based in Saudi Arabia. Mr. Al-Mayina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here in the United States, the news of Saddam's capture has affected the presidential race. Democratic candidates had been focusing on the chaotic situation in Iraq, and they often cited President Bush's failure to find Saddam. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports on what the Democrats are saying now.
The capture of Saddam Hussein will probably be a political boost for President Bush, at least in the short term, but it will also, in the short term, make it a little more complicated for Democrats to argue that President Bush is bungling the occupation. Today, Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, who co-sponsored the resolution allowing the president to go to war, issued a statement saying, "Today is a great day for our troops." He reminded voters that he supported the war because it was the right thing to do, and that he still feels that way now. Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, who's been the most outspoken supporter of the war, began his statement by saying, "Hallelujah, praise the Lord." He went on to explain how he thinks the news changes the Democratic race.
It's a choice between Howard Dean, who wants to go backward, and I, who want to take our party forward from where Bill Clinton brought it. And our positions on Iraq could not be more clearly different. The fact is that if Howard Dean had his way, Saddam Hussein would be in power today, not in prison where he belongs. And the world and America would be much less safe.
Dean himself, who achieved his front-runner status in the race largely because of his strident anti-war position, issued a statement congratulating the troops and saying, "Now that the dictator is captured, we must also accelerate the transition from occupation to full Iraqi sovereignty." Retired General Wesley Clark, another anti-war candidate, said he hoped the capture would lead to a diminution of the violence against American soldiers in Iraq.
I think it's fortuitous he was taken alive because I think it's very important that in matters like this, that he actually be put on trial, and I hope the trial will be conducted by an appropriate authority in accordance with the highest legal standards.
And Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, who voted for the war and has been struggling to explain his vote ever since, said today that he had voted to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. He said today's news was terrific, but that it didn't solve the problem.
I think this is now a great opportunity for the President of the United States to really get it right in Iraq. I mean, I've said all along that we ought to hold him accountable. We ought to do it with a real coalition. We ought to do it in a way that maximizes the opportunity for success and reduces the cost to the American people in lives and dollars. This is a golden opportunity to get other countries involved, to show a bigness, a magnanimity, to say that we've now accomplished the sort of decapitation of the regime in full. Now we're going to rebuild Iraq, and we want the world to take a stake in it.
Former Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun issued a statement saying that the capture of Saddam Hussein did not change the fact that our troops remain in harm's way and we are no closer to bringing them home. Former President Bill Clinton, still the titular head of his party, issued a statement congratulating President Bush and the soldiers who found Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and he said he hoped Saddam's capture would speed Iraq's transition to a secure and self-governing nation and would increase international support for that process. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
The people following the news from Iraq include Sergeant Rick Mosby, who is with the 143rd Military Police, a National Guard unit based in Connecticut. Much of that unit has already gone to Iraq, and Sergeant Mosby will be going soon. Right now, he's at Fort Drum in upstate New York. And Sergeant, can you tell us how you heard the news today?
By television.
What time? You woke up in the middle of the night and...
I heard it by 6 o'clock this morning. It was all over the news.
You got up in the morning and there it was.
Right.
And what has happened through the day as the day has developed at Fort Drum?
Well, most concern here is that what are they going to charge this guy with, and is he going to be cooperative, you know? And could he actually tell us where the weapon of mass destruction are located at and what country are they in?
And I guess you have to be thinking, is this capture going to be making my job any easier once I get sent over there?
Right, because, you know, now... you bring a whole lot of things into play, you know, like, is it really going to be safer by being over there now since they caught this guy, you know?
Which makes me wonder, are there wild celebrations at Fort Drum, or is it more a sense of curiosity and just wondering about the future?
It's just, it's peaceful right now, you know. A lot of friends and myself are discussing the situation. A lot of people ready to go to serve the country. We're happy that we caught this guy, first of all. And second of all, what's going to happen when we actually get there, you know? But by speaking to the people that actually came back, you know, it's a hostile environment. My concerns, I have a wife and three children, and their concern was today, Sergeant, are you going or are you coming back home to us? You know, that's their concern, my family concern.
That's what they've been asking you today?
Yes.
How old are your kids?
A daughter is 16, one 13, and a 9-year-old.
And they're back in Connecticut while you're in upstate New York, right?
Yes, they are.
So you've been on the phone with them today?
Yes, I have.
And
their concern is about the whole war. You know, is it necessary? Should we be there? You know, all the innocent people have gotten killed, you know, recently. They just think we should not be there.
And
ready for it all to end.
And the capture of Saddam Hussein doesn't necessarily change their thinking on that score.
Exactly. They think it's going to be a little worse because they don't know that who's in charge over there now. And that's my concerns also. Are American troops really in charge over there or someone else in charge?
Sergeant Rick Mosby is a member of the 143rd Military Police, which is a National Guard unit. He is expecting soon to be sent to Iraq. Sergeant, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News, and we will have more during this hour on the capture of Saddam Hussein. But we would like to take just a minute here to update you on some of the other stories in the news today. First, a 78-year-old Los Angeles woman says she is the illegitimate mixed-race daughter of the late Senator Strom Thurmond. Thurmond of South Carolina was once an ardent segregationist. S.E. Mae Washington Williams, though, says she has financial records and personal correspondence that prove her relation to him. Her mother worked as the Thurmond family maid. And former Senator William Roth has died. He was a Delaware Republican who served 5 terms in the U.S. Senate. He was a tireless crusader for tax cuts and was best known for the savings account that bears his name, the Roth IRA. Also in Pakistan today, the country's president, Pervez Musharraf, narrowly escaped assassination. A bomb exploded just seconds after his motorcade passed a bridge near the capital, Islamabad, and this is the second attempt on Musharraf's life since he aligned his country with the United States in the war on terrorism. Now, news of Saddam Hussein's capture sent a buzz around the opening day of Afghanistan's constitutional convention in the capital city of Kabul, but that did little to distract from an early showdown between President Hamid Karzai, he wants a strong presidential system, and opponents who say parliament should have more power. From Kabul, NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Verses from the Quran opened Afghanistan's Constitutional Grand Council, or Loya Jirga. The 500 delegates and plenty of observers met under a very big tent, protected by multiple rings of security forces. Delegates came in a variety of attire, turbans, leather jackets, and long quilted coats. They listened with only occasional applause as transitional President Hamid Karzai argued that for now at least, Afghanistan needs a government with one source of power, the presidency.
We do not have strong national political parties in Afghanistan. If we establish a parliamentary system, we will give power to people with guns. Experience shows this would lead to people seeking private gains, not acting in the national interest and for the national prosperity. This would pave the way for more war.
Karzai's first challenge from the assembly floor came during the election of a chairman for the Loya Jirga. Candidate Abdul Hafiz Mansour said he was inspired by a song a children's group performed during the opening ceremony. The song accuses everyone who has taken power in Afghanistan of stealing treasures from the homeland for personal luxury. Mansour, a top official with an Islamist party that fought against the Soviet occupation of the 80s, said the government is trying to make a constitution that suits its private needs.
At the last Loya Jirga, I pushed for a parliamentary system, but everyone came up with different excuses. If you vote for me, I would turn you, the Loya Jirga delegates, into a temporary parliament until elections are held.
Mansour called for the dismissal of the 50 delegates appointed by Karzai. The rest were elected by local leaders. Mansour got about a third of the delegates' support for chairman, but he was beaten by a candidate largely viewed as a Karzai ally, an early victory for the president that could signal the direction the rest of the meeting will take. The issue of president versus parliament is not the only struggle. On a busy street in central Kabul, ordinary people seem to be as split as the Loya Jirga delegates. Four different men say four different things. One wants a return to the monarchy. Another believes orthodox Islamic law should be the basis for government. A third says a just government must provide equal rights for men and women. A fourth writes off the Loya Jirga as a waste of time, saying there is no mechanism to enforce any laws. Emily Harris, NPR News, Kabul.
And we'll return now to the story of the day, the capture of Saddam Hussein. Next, we're going to review his astonishing career. Saddam ruled Iraq for nearly a quarter century, taking the nation into disastrous wars, first with Iran and then with the United States and its allies. NPR's Mike Schuster has this look back on the career of Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein was the preeminent strongman in Iraq since the late 1960s, but his name did not become a household word in the United States until August 2, 1990, when he launched his army on a blitzkrieg attack against Kuwait. In response, the United States built up a military force half a million strong in Saudi Arabia and in the waters of the Persian Gulf, and President George Bush gave the orders to go to war against Iraq on January 16, 1991.
Tonight, 28 nations, countries from five continents, Europe and Asia, Africa and the Arab League, have forces in the Gulf area standing shoulder to shoulder against Saddam Hussein. These countries had hoped the use of force could be avoided. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
Saddam Hussein also took to the airwaves that night to appeal to all Arabs everywhere to rise up against the United States in the great battle between the Arab world and the infidels.
At 2:30 a.m. tonight, on the 16th of January, the treacherous foes and Bush, the Satan, has perpetrated his crime. He and the criminal Zionism. And the great battle has been initiated, the mother of all battles.
The mother of all battles proved to be short-lived. Allied warplanes pounded Iraq and Iraqi forces in Kuwait for nearly 2 months. Then a ground invasion took back Kuwait in 100 hours, leaving tens of thousands of Iraqis killed, but only 500 Allied deaths. Saddam Hussein's life was permeated by violence, in wars, in coups successful and unsuccessful, in assassination, treachery, and terrorism. Born in the central Iraqi town of Tikrit in 1936, Saddam learned violence at an early age. By the time he was a teenager, his biographers say he had carried out his first killing, the murder of a communist militant, the weapon, a knife. In 1959, he was a member of the hit squad that sought to assassinate Iraq's military leader, Abdul Karim Qasem. Qasem's car was riddled with bullets, but he survived. Saddam was wounded in the leg and fled to Cairo. He returned to Iraq a few years later and began to organize gangs for the Rising Ba'ath Party. When the Ba'ath took power in 1968, Saddam became Iraq's second most powerful leader, turning his gangs into an intricate array of secret police organizations that would eventually infiltrate every aspect of Iraq's political life. Saddam took the supreme spot for himself in 1979, eliminating his rivals in a power grab captured on videotape. The scene was a meeting of Iraq's Revolutionary Command Council. Kenan Makia is the author of a study of Saddam's Iraq, Republic of Fear.
You have a cigar-smoking Saddam Hussein in the beginning, chairing the session, and then beginning to read out a speech in which he suddenly announces, to the amazement of his audience, that this huge conspiracy has been detected at various levels. And then he calls out people's names, and you can see them standing up in bewilderment and then being taken out of the hall. He then goes and sits down in the front ranks, and one of the alleged conspirators gets up and details a whole long confession as to how he actually did participate in this obviously fabricated conspiracy.
Those who were taken out of the hall were shot by those who had allied themselves with Saddam. A year later, Saddam made the first of his great political miscalculations. With the Islamic Revolution only a year old in neighboring Iran, Saddam ordered his troops to invade. The Iran-Iraq War lasted for 8 years and eventually ended in stalemate. Saddam called it the Second Qadisiyah, a reference to the battle in the 7th century, in which an Arab conquering army brought Islam to Persia. This betrayed his enormous ambitions to be the great leader who unites all Arabs into one of the world's richest and most powerful nations. Oil and arms would be the means. Saddam spent billions to acquire an enormous arsenal, which would include an effort to obtain nuclear weapons. And, Kenan Makia says, the people of Iraq would see concrete benefits from this effort.
He built the infrastructure of this country like no other regime had. This was, of course, made possible by oil revenues. One way or another, he frog-marched the country into very high attention to literacy, built universities all over the place, put enormous investment into technocratic technical elite, which was the basis of his military complex.
But the war with Iran put enormous strains on the economy of Iraq. Saddam needed more resources, and in 1990, he seized Kuwait and its oil fields, claiming that Kuwait was actually a province of Iraq. The invasion of Kuwait was Saddam's second great political and military miscalculation, says Andrew Parasoliti, director of the Middle East Initiative at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard.
I think that Saddam Hussein believed that the United States suffered from the Vietnam syndrome, that he didn't believe that the United States had the military capability or will, more importantly, or will to mount a sustained military attack on Iraq, and that the first American casualties would divide the United States or undermine political will to conduct this operation.
The Gulf War devastated Iraq and nearly toppled Saddam. In the north, the Kurds rose up against his rule, and in the south, Shiite Muslims rebelled. Saddam unleashed his military on both. The United States looked the other way, and Saddam retained power in Baghdad. After that, says Andrew Parasoliti, Saddam could no longer cast himself as the modern-day Saladin, who defeated the Crusaders and captured Jerusalem in the name of Islam 800 years ago.
After the defeat in the Kuwait War, I think that Saddam's ambitions became more limited. The war caused him to focus on survival. The devastating military defeat in the war, the uprising that took place in 1991, these were signals to him that his position was not as secure as he might have hoped.
In the years after the Gulf War, Saddam continued to fight the U.S. and the West, but it was a more subtle war. It involved a hide-and-seek game with U.N. weapons inspectors over whether Iraq retained chemical and biological weapons, and it involved an international propaganda struggle over economic sanctions, which the United Nations imposed in part to rid Iraq of its prohibited weapons. Saddam proved as intransigent on this issue as he had on all others, and it brought a confrontation with another U.S. president, Bill Clinton, who ordered the four-day bombing of Iraq in December 1998.
I am convinced the decision I made to order this military action, though difficult, was absolutely the right thing to do. It is in our interest and in the interest of people all around the world. Saddam Hussein has used weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles before. I have no doubt he would use them again if permitted to develop them.
As he did after the Gulf War, Saddam cast this too as a victory for Iraq.
We had only very light losses, thanks be to God. This was being a failed attempt by the Americans. May God have mercy on our martyrs. God is most great. God is most great.
After decades in power, Saddam Hussein was forced out of Baghdad with astonishing speed. Just a few weeks after the U.S. military began its assault on Iraq last March, the Iraqi leader and his loyalists disappeared. He issued an occasional defiant message in the months that followed, and his disappearance was a constant embarrassment to the Bush administration, as was the absence of any evidence that weapons of mass destruction remained in Iraq. But his time as a fugitive ended without resistance. The former dictator who covered Iraq with monuments to himself was hiding in a hole, accompanied only by a pair of assistants and a taxicab. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
Saddam Hussein may not have personally directed the Iraqi resistance from his hiding place near Tikrit, but today U.S. officials expressed hope that his capture might help to pacify the country. President Bush, Paul Bremer, and others reassured Iraqis that Saddam Hussein is not coming back. Until now, even some Iraqis who passionately opposed Saddam in private were reluctant to show that in public. They feared that Saddam, the ultimate survivor, would return. Some conspiracy theorists even suggested that Saddam was an American puppet who might be restored with American help. In Iraq last spring, when the U.S. victory seemed almost complete, I met a college professor who'd once been jailed by Saddam's government. He said he was afraid to risk working as an interpreter for a foreign journalist. He finally agreed to take that chance because his family desperately needed the money. But many other Iraqis said they were afraid to cooperate with Americans. Though Iraqis still face many threats, from joblessness to suicide bombers, U.S. officials clearly hope that the videotape of a shaggy, bearded, defeated Saddam Hussein may ease their fears. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Lee and Lawrence Raymer for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future. From Frederica and Howard Stevenson, recognizing Summer Search Foundation, committed to encouraging long-term change in at-risk teens. Information at summersearch.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
All Things Considered is made possible in part by a grant from the Brown Bag Deli Restaurant, Homemade Pies by Inge, Gourmet Foods, Cards and Gifts, as well as Creative Crafts, Zimmer Art Gallery, Wacky Nackies, The Bean Scene Cafe, Gallery Virtue, and Prairie Fire Glass, all housed in the same buildings in downtown Monticello.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with areas of fog, the low in the mid-20s with southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, shifting to the south after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning, the high in the lower 40s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, cloudy with a chance of light rain after midnight, the low in the upper 30s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, now live on the web 24 hours a day at WILL.UIUC.edu. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.